Clements set this up, actually. And it's kind of a cool book. It's free to read. The platform is MediaWiki, which is the same platform as Wikipedia, but you need a password to edit it. The idea was that it would be fully linked. So if you go through the, if you're reading through and you see a reference, you can click on it, it'll take you to the references, and then you can hit the back button and go back to where you were reading. So that's true for equations and tables and figures. It has a detailed table of contents at the top of each chapter or page, and it also has, the beginnings of a glossary, which was Ian Durham's idea. It's introductory, but there is room for advanced topics, and if somebody wants to put something else on here, the server was purchased with NSF money, and right now it houses this wiki book and not much else. It has introductory appendices and we were going to make a part two for advanced topics. So anyway, you're welcome to read it, and I'd appreciate any feedback. I'd like it to be useful. So it is sort of a secondary recommended text for some courses that I know of. Okay, so I wanted to talk about correlations and open system evolution. And so at first, I'll just give an introduction, which is in part for notation and also for some definitions in case people are not everyone is familiar with those. Then I'll talk about some examples, which I think are a bit motivational and help understand what's going on. Then I'll talk about a degree of freedom in this operator sum representation or cross representation for maps from one density operator to another. And then if there's enough time, I'll go through this. Actually, altogether, I only timed it for about 45 minutes, so there's time for questions. So I'm fine with people asking questions during the talk. So this is the idea. We have access to some system A. We want to map that system to itself somehow. And then we have access to the system after the mapping. And the map, sort of generically, I'll call phi, but also there are different ways. And this script E is also basically the same thing as phi. But A, B, and T are different representations of phi. So I'll talk about those later. But these are all basically just maps from system A to system A. And if it was just system A, then it might be a nice, clean, reasonably simple thing. But if we have a bath, sort of muddies the waters, and we have to consider more than just a simple system A evolution without regard to anything else, because this bath B can have an effect on system A, not just during the evolution, but if there's at some time before we start, whatever, say, unitary evolution, for example, that we have here, if the system A and B are entangled or correlated in some other ways with each other, then it can make a big difference for the outcome after the map. So I thought maybe the laser pointer was shaking, but it wasn't. Okay. So I have to say there are things in this, I think this is a very interesting topic. But there are several things in here that I'll admit to not understanding extremely well. But then if we knew what we were doing, it wouldn't be called research, right? So I'm happy to answer questions during the talk. If you have some questions about something. And if I don't know the answer, I'll just tell you I don't know. To begin with, Sudarshan, Matthews, and Rao in 61 described this, what they call a dynamical map from one density operator to another. You take into account that the density operator should be Hermitian, positive semi-definite, meaning no negative eigenvalues, and have trace 1. And then what they did was they wrote down a sort of generic map from one density operator to another. There are formal ways you can express these things, but the way I look at this is just, this is a matrix which acts on a vector. So you just think about ordering the, for example, for a qubit, the elements of the density operator, row 1, 1, row 1, 2, row 2, 1, row 2, 2, and then you act on that column vector with a matrix, and then you get another matrix. You get another column vector from that. So if so, this is it's pretty clear to see this is quite a general mapping. But if you want to begin with a density operator and get a density operator in the end, then you have to put some restrictions on A. And this is the one that I'm primarily going to be concerned with here, which is the condition to map, for A to map Hermitian operators to Hermitian operators. So if you switch R prime and S prime and R and S and take the complex conjugate, you should get the same thing back again. You can also write down positivity conditions and trace preserving conditions for A in order to ensure that you map density operators to density operators. If you, yes?
So you consider only linear maps.
Right.
Definition.
Right. Okay. Exactly. So, and it's kind of easy to see that there's no affine part to add here. You don't need it. You can absorb it into the A. So, you can define a B matrix or a B map just by rearranging the elements of A. So this is another matrix B. And if you go back to the conditions for A to be Hermitian positive and trace preserving, you can translate those into properties of B. And the one that I am interested in at the moment is this one. So if you switch R and R prime and S prime and S in pairs, this corresponds to the condition that A map Hermitian matrices to Hermitian matrices, or same thing for B. But what this means really is that B itself is Hermitian. So if B is Hermitian, then we can use a spectral decomposition to decompose B into eigenvectors and eigenvalues. And so here, gamma is the gammas are eigenvalues, and the c's are eigenvectors. And we can get rid of, we can write this a little more neatly by absorbing these gammas into the c's and defining that to be A. And then the coefficients are just plus or minus 1 corresponding to whether the eigenvalues are either positive or negative. So we just absorb the magnitudes into the operators. So if all of those are positive, then we get this form, and this is what people very often call the Krauss operator sum decomposition or Krauss decomposition. And this is, but this one I refer to as the operator sum decomposition because he primarily concentrated on things where all the eta's were plus 1. So it's kind of interesting to note, it's a nice relation that if you look at these as eigenvectors or whether you look at these as matrices, which is what we very often do when we write the Krauss form, the inner product of the eigenvalues can be written like this, of the eigenvectors can be written like this, and this corresponds to the orthogonality of the matrices or the orthogonality of the eigenvectors, depending on which way you write them, either as vectors or matrices. And this is called, this eigenvector decomposition is called a a minimal decomposition of the map because you can't write it with fewer A's because all of these A's are linearly independent, which follows from the spectral decomposition. So the map is almost unique as is the spectral decomposition. The plus or minus ones here, I'll talk about this more in a minute. But you can write this as something that has this form minus something else that has this same form. And people have gone to great lengths to prove that in more difficult ways, I think. But this is a simple proof of how that works. If you have a map that maps all positive operators to positive operators, it's called a positive map, or positive matrices to positive matrices. I use density operator and density matrix interchangeably. So anyway, if you consider a map of this form, and you suppose that phi is positive, and when you extend it by an n-by-n identity matrix, it's called, if this is positive, it's called n-positive, and if it's positive for all n, then it's called completely positive, and it turns out that you only have to check a certain number of n's before you can determine that it's completely positive. There are a few theorems that will tell you how many n's you have to check, basically. So the claim in the past was that this extension shouldn't change the positivity, that somehow, you know, we should only consider completely positive maps.
Question?
Yeah?
Is that also true if phi is acting on an infinite dimensional Hilbert space?
I'm thinking of finite dimensional Hilbert spaces here, actually. So this is a mapping of an n-state system. This is a mapping of some other, not necessarily the same dimension, but some other finite dimensional system. So I actually don't know how much of this has been done. Some of this has been extended to infinite dimensional systems, but I don't know exactly how much. Okay, so it turns out that you can find relevant maps that are not completely positive, even though this was emphasized for quite some time. And I'll show a few examples in a minute. And there's a theorem that says that the map is completely positive if and only if all of these etas are plus one. That is, the map B has only positive eigenvalues. So that's what I'm going to use for complete positivity from now on. So I'm only going to worry about the signs of the etas. Now, the standard derivation of an open system evolution is that you start with a simple product state of A and B, then you evolve them together with some unitary transformation that acts on both, and then you trace over B, and you get the mapping of this density operator A to some new density operator. And this, of course, here we're assuming that the system and Bath are initially not correlated at all. And if you do this, it's easy to show if you go through the algebra that all of the eta are positive. And so this is a completely positive map. So now there's something called discord, and I'll show you why it's relevant in a moment. But I just want to define it here for those of you who don't know what it is. If you take some bipartite quantum system, so there's two different systems here, you can compute the mutual information either by calculating I, or you can calculate J. For classical systems, if these are just classical probability distributions, it turns out that J is always equal to I. For quantum systems, though, how you extract the information makes a difference. So you decide on some measurements you would like to make in order to extract information from the system, and depending on the outcomes of those measurements, that tells you what sort of information you acquire. And so it turns out that J equal to I, that's just not always true for quantum systems. And the discord is the difference between these two. Now, sometimes they can be correlated. If they're entangled, it turns out the discord is maximal. It's the difference between these two is as large as it'll get. there's a theorem that was proved, two different papers. One way was proved in one paper and the other way in another paper, that zero discord, the quantum discord being zero, is necessary and sufficient to ensure completely positive evolution. That is, you always get a completely positive map if the quantum discord is zero.
Wait, sorry, the quantum discord of what?
Pardon?
The quantum discord of what?
Of this. You start with something like this, bipartite.
Of the initial state.
Initial state, right.
You mean the system environment.
System environment, initial state, right.
And, exactly. And then do a unitary.
Then you can do a unitary, and then you would trace over B, and you would get the final map. So the point is that if there are some initial correlations, they can be of a certain type, and the discord might still be zero, okay? And so they refer to these as classically correlated states. And if the quantum discord or the discord is non-zero, then you say they're correlated somehow quantum mechanically. So it's different than entanglement. Entangled states have non-zero discord, but there are other states that are correlated that have non-zero discord that are not entangled. So
maybe this is a time to ask a question that you can clear this up for me about this whole, the whole issue.
I'll try.
So you want to say that the overall evolution is completely positive in this statement.
If the discord is zero, yes?
Right. Yeah, I understand
right.
that. But now you're making an assumption, I mean, it's a question, it's an assumption about the initial state of both A and B.
Right.
But the map is defined just on A.
Right.
So clearly what happens depends also on what's going on in B, and that's the whole
absolutely concept. That's the whole point. Exactly.
So how is it an evolution on A? I mean, it's not uniquely defined, right?
Well, this goes back to my picture. So I have this A and I have this other A, right? And I'm mapping A to itself. What I do initially is I only have access to system A, so I only measure system A. It could be entangled
sure.
or correlated with a bath, I don't know. When I measure it, when I make these measurements, I only see something about A, and I won't be able to tell whether it's entangled or not. All I know is what the initial density operator is, because I take that system and I run it through my process tomography.
Sure.
But
the point is, you could have a different system that has the same density operator on A.
Yes.
But will give a different outcome because
yes.
it has something different on B.
Exactly.
So,
but that one, if you have a different, so for example, and this is a question that I haven't answered actually,
okay.
which I think is an interesting question. So that's exactly right, and I think that's a very good point. You could have a density operator, and so initially you could be mistaken about what your density operator is, in the sense that you make a measurement, but measurements are uncertain in practice, so there's some uncertainty in your initial measurement. Then you find out your map is not completely positive. Is it entangled with the environment or correlated with the environment in some way initially? Or did you just make a mistake? This was actually an experiment, and this is part of what started a lot of, well, my interest in it anyway, and some other people's as well. But initially, you don't know whether it's entangled or not. You just make the measurement. When you evolve it and you make the, you know, you do process tomography at some particular time or state tomography, at some particular time later, you get a density operator there, you can find the mapping between those two, and the mapping between those two is either positive or not. I mean, completely positive or not. You can tell by looking at the eigenvalues of the B matrix.
I think what Dan is asking, how do you have a map? A well-defined map means you could put in any density matrix for the initial density matrix of A, and then you should be able to get out some density corresponding
right,
to density
right.
matrix.
There's
density, but here it seems like you just have one density matrix and it goes to one other density matrix.
Right.
But then we have to ask, what would this same map do if we change the initial density matrix?
Right.
And that seems a little bit ill-defined.
I wouldn't say it's ill-defined. It's ambiguous, though. I mean, that map may be ambiguous, right? You may have more than one map that would do that.
Well, kind of. I mean, but actually, it's still defined in the following sense, is that even if you don't change the initial density matrix, it could be that you get a different outcome, again, because system B is different, right? I mean, it's not.
You mean doing the experiment over again, you mean?
Yeah, you do the experiment over again, but something about the initial state has changed. But you don't know that it changed because you have the same density matrix for A, even if your measurement is perfect.
Right, but there has to be some repeatability here. Otherwise, I mean, how do we define the initial state? So that's an ambiguity in defining the initial state. Right. I mean, if you send in different initial states and you don't get something consistent, okay.
But
let's suppose that we are able to send in different initial states and we get, again and again, same initial state again and again, we get the same.
So do you assume that?
Yes.
So okay. When you say initial state, are you talking about the state on the subsystem A or
yes.
Okay, not the joint state.
Right.
So do you assume that for every choice of initial state on system A, there's some uniquely defined global state for A plus B that it corresponds to? Is that the assumption?
Some unique defined global state for A plus B? No.
No.
No. In fact, I'll talk about that later. So maybe that will.
Well, I think yeah. Okay. So this is right. So there's the two separate questions of whether
right.
it's defined for all density matrices
right.
and whether it's defined even
yes.
for a single density
and,
matrix.
And what I would claim is that you should be able to define it for a single density matrix, although it might
okay.
be somewhat ambiguous. The map might be somewhat
right,
ambiguous.
Okay.
For a single state. Now, what I was going to tell you later, what I'll tell you now, is that it does depend on the initial state. I mean, when I go through the examples, I'll talk about this more. But it does depend on the initial state. You can't really, and it's difficult to separate these things properly. But I'll get to some examples in a minute. So the discord being zero is necessary and sufficient for a completely positive map. So now I'll talk about a couple of examples. Maybe this will help. So this is an example in these two papers.
I just want to wrap up that previous discussion. So again, you said zero discord being sufficient, meaning that there exists a completely positive map that's consistent with this mapping of one density matrix. If the discord is zero.
If the discord is zero, that means the map is completely positive.
But I mean,
you might
you said
still have
ambiguity
some...
in what the map is. So you mean
yes.
that there exists a completely positive map that's consistent with this?
Yes.
Or is that there's no ambiguity?
If the discord is zero, yes.
Okay.
But there exists a completely positive map which is consistent with mapping a density operator to another? That's what you're pointing
out? Yeah.
But I mean, there exists, all for any given pair, there exists such a... I'm confused about...
I think what Ewan's trying to say is, suppose you have entanglement between S,
yeah,
the system and the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So now you figure out what the unitary takes you to the final state of the system. So say the initial state is rho S, that's the reduction on the system, and the final state is rho S prime.
So you figure out this unitary? What?
So you're saying you're given a unitary that couples the system and the environment.
Yeah, so I'm not assuming I know any of that at all. I'm just assuming that I measure some input state and I measure some output state from some experiment, and that's all I have. I don't know anything about the unitary. It could be that I implement the unitary in addition to whatever else is going on or has gone on. But as far as the environment coupling, I'm going to assume I know nothing about that.
Okay, so in that context, you know, if you've characterized the initial reduced state on the system,
mm-hmm.
rho
mm-hmm.
s, and you've characterized the final reduced state on the system, rho
yes.
s prime, then there always exists a CP map that takes rho s to rho s prime, just the one that traces and then re-prepares rho s prime. That's CP. So why do I need a failure of CP if I'm only interested in how this map acts on rho s alone? It seems you need some variability in the state of the system.
No, actually, so you can take this for an example.
Okay.
So suppose that this is my initial state. This is correlated, okay, in some way with its, So the first subsystem, these are just two qubits. So the first subsystem and the second subsystem are correlated, right? There's a correlation C23, okay? Some number that specifies this correlation. This matrix is separable. It's not entangled. because if you take the transpose on the second subsystem, it leaves the state alone. So it's definitely non-entangled. Okay? And now if you evolve it like this, with this unitary transformation, you act on this, U dagger, and then you trace over B, what you get is these eigenvalues for B. So you can see here that there are different values for C, 2, 3, and the time, T, such that, say, for example, this one could be negative. And that is true if and only if this map is not completely positive. Okay? So I have an initial density operator for system A that's identity plus A dot sigma, right? And then I have a final one, which I get from this unitary plus chasing over B, whatever that is. And the map that describes that evolution has a B matrix with a negative eigenvalue, so it's not completely positive.
So actually, it's not positive, then?
It is not completely positive. Is this one positive? Is it positive for all inputs? I think it is positive for all positive input states. That is, if you choose these parameters in such a way that this density operator is positive, I think you always get a positive operator out.
What are the parameters?
I think so.
A and C?
Although there are examples of physical maps, which is what I was going to say before, such that the map itself is not positive. So it's not necessarily a problem. Positivity just means it takes all positive operators to positive operators, right? So if you find a physically relevant example with an initially positive density operator, and it maps via some reasonable evolution to a positive operator, even though it may not, if you change the initial state, right, it may not map that to a positive operator. That wouldn't be physical, but this one might be physically reasonable, even though the map itself is not only not completely positive, it's not positive.
To define B, you had to assume linearity, right?
To define B?
B was the transformation that acted linearly on your initial state. So now you are starting with a correlated state of the two systems.
Uh-huh.
I'm not exactly sure about how you can derive even the notion of B, in a sense.
You need more constraints.
No, I mean, it's actually very simple. If you go back to the A, and then you find B, it's actually, mathematically, it's pretty straightforward. Conceptually, it's maddening, as you can see from the questions, right? And I have difficulty with some things conceptually, and I'll get to some more of those later. So if you think it's bad already, wait, it gets worse.
No,
question?
I mean, that's just a thing for Rob again, right? I mean, so it means that you can construct some map which is not completely positive that maps it correspondingly. But there's always the other example that exists is where the positive, completely positive map connecting them, right? For A and
there exists. Right? No, I mean, the A map and B map are essentially unique. I mean, once you find input A and output A, the map is essentially unique. I mean, you write down A, right? A takes you from rho to rho prime, and then you do a spectral decomposition on B, which you get directly from A, and then this tells you whether.
There are maps
that are not completely positive. I mean, you can go through this one yourself. You can
it. Certainly, I think people believe that there are maps that are not completely positive.
Yeah, and that's because
about defining the problem exactly, right?
Pardon?
So that's something about defining the problem again. So what is exactly the problem that we're talking about?
The problem we're talking about is that I start with a system which is could be correlated or otherwise entangled with another system, and I only have access to the first system. I measure it, I evolve it in some way, and then I measure the first system again on the output, and I see what the density operator is. And when I do that, I can write down the A, and then I get B, and then I get.
So in this example. I see the C23.
I'm glad this is entitled discussion. This is great, right?
So the C23 appears in the answer, but the A vector does not. Is that right?
Took your choice of A.
No. Well, this is one example here. You can't choose them completely arbitrarily because then the density operator, initial density operator, may not be positive, right?
Okay.
So you want to choose them such that the initial density operator is in fact positive. This is one example. It's a very simple example, and I've played with this one a little bit, and so that one's pretty easy. And what you find is almost as immediately for small times here, this eigenvalue is negative.
What do you mean by the B map? Somehow I got lost.
That's fine.
Later.
So this is A, right? It's just a matrix which maps a vector to a vector, okay? This is B. B is just A, but I've rearranged some entries. I just rewritten the matrix. Pardon?
Is it the Choi matrix?
Well, you can call it what you want, but you just rearrange it. And I got this from the Sudarshan paper. He was my PhD supervisor.
It's the map that takes the initial density matrix to the final density matrix.
Yes.
But with the indices in range in such a way that when it's positive, that means complete positivity.
Yes.
And it's a positive range.
Yes. The point of doing that rearrangement is that B then is Hermitian, so you can do the eigenvector eigenvalue decomposition. And then at this point, you can see that any map which takes Hermitian matrices to Hermitian matrices is the difference of two completely positive maps. Question?
So A is a linear map that acts on the space of density operators on the principal system, A, right?
Yes.
And we have one input and can compute the corresponding output of this map.
Right.
So how does this define the entire map?
That's what I'm saying. If you have a single input and a single output, it's ambiguous. It doesn't define it uniquely.
So how did you know what the B map was in that example? That's the question.
Well, right. So for a single input, well, you can do this for many inputs if you want to. Okay. But you can, we'll have to go through the example. Maybe tomorrow I'll give a talk on the example. I have all the details worked out, so it's not as bad as it. Okay, well, so I'm actually going to skip the second example. I'm just going to run through what was my motivation, what was on my idea and motivation. So, but I don't want to go through in all detail. There's a model that someone suggested simulating on an NMR device, and it's called the Fano-Anderson model. And we did this for just 2 qubits, and we added a bath, and we explored different initial states. So there's a particular control Hamiltonian to simulate the thing. And then we just wanted to see, in some physical circumstances, are there ways that you would come up with maps that are not completely positive. And in fact, we found some sort of simple things that might occur in your system that would lead you to a not completely positive map. But I don't want to talk about that too much. So, okay. So we're going to, right. So, there are physically relevant maps that are not completely positive. Initial correlations can lead to these not completely positive maps. And so it turns out that the circumstances don't seem that rare, at least in our fiddling with this simulation model. So now I'll go from bad to worse and see. Okay, so there is so this is directly related, basically. So there is a theorem, I think it's called the unitary theorem anyway, that's what I call it, which describes a unitary degree of freedom in the operator sum representation. So for completely positive maps, you can write them like this, and it turns out that the form of the map is not unique. But if you picked a different set of f, of operators f, You could wind up with the same map if the operators A are related to the operators F by a unitary matrix, basically. So this set of numbers that form the linear combinations of the A's, if they form a unitary matrix, then you can plug this in and actually see that you wind up with the same map. So this, the earliest I found this comment was in this paper, but it's also in Nielsen and Chuang. And so the way they interpret this unitary degree of freedom is they purify the bath, and then they say, okay, this is this unitary degree of freedom turns out to be a choice of basis of the bath. So, right. So where do you use this? You actually use this in one place is in the quantum error correcting code condition. So I like this sort of more intuitive form a bit better, but you can show that this is true if and only if this is true, where the P's here are projectors onto the code space. The A's here are the operators from the operator sum decomposition, and here this basically says that if I operate with one error here and another error here, if I is different from J, I should get zero over here. Otherwise, if I have two different errors acting on two different states and the overlap is non-zero, then you can't necessarily distinguish those. Right, there it's ambiguous which state you have. And so these give you conditions in order to develop a quantum error correcting code that can protect against these errors if you consider this map to be resulting from errors. Okay, so it turns out that what you do is you use the unitary degree of freedom to diagonalize this matrix by acting on these, choosing same map, but you choose a different set of operators such that this matrix is diagonal. So this is how the proof proceeds. So I'll go through that in a minute. But there's a pseudo-unitary degree of freedom for maps that are not completely positive. And if maps are not completely positive, you have some plus ones and minus ones out front, right? And so this form is, again, not unique. You can pick a different set of operators, F, if and only if these U's here are from a, or form a, these numbers form a pseudo-unitary matrix. And pseudo-unitary means, one way of thinking about it is this: if you do U, I, U dagger, or U dagger, I, U, you get the identity. Pseudo-unitary means if you use U dagger, eta, you get eta back. Eta is a diagonal matrix, which has a certain number of plus ones and a certain number of minus ones. And there is a fairly common example of this sort of pseudo-unitary transformation, which is the Lorentz group, SO13 or 31. But if you write it in this way, it fixes this metric, right? So this is the real part of, say, U13. And so, right, special orthogonal. And so this is what we call the pseudo-unitary theorem. So it's a degree of freedom in the in this operator sum representation. So you would imagine that, well, it's a different looking map. It might have different physical circumstances that lead to the same evolution, which is also how you would interpret the unitary degree of freedom. But but I would say that this is not understood very well. In fact, you can't purify a single bath and model it that way. It doesn't work that way. So I this is a bit more difficult to understand. So I haven't quite understood that myself. So then, you know, probably see where we're going with this. So
sorry, what was the motivation to that? Were you looking for a sort of general form for positive but not CP map, or general form for any map of density matrices?
What's the motivation for the pseudo unitary?
No, for this ansatz that you made. What's that meant to do? That's an arbitrary hermeticity preserving map.
Oh, this one here?
Yeah.
Yes.
And then you're looking to see whether it could be gotten by some generalization of purification or something?
No. The pseudo-unitary theorem says that there are different sets of operators, F, that will give you the same map. So the map itself is not unique.
Right.
So two different baths, for example, which is how we interpret this one. The way we interpret this is that there are different, basically, baths that could still give you the same map. The baths look different, but nevertheless, the same input state would result in the same output state. So it's the same map.
But these are baths in some generalized sense of the word, right? Is it?
I'm not sure what you mean. Baths in the sense that it's just another system that the first couples to.
If you have it at that form, you can't always realize that by just coupling it to some bath. Or is that the claim? That's what I'm not understanding. Are you claiming that any hermeticity preserving map can be realized by coupling the subsystem to some bath and doing some unitarium?
Well, at the moment,
pseudo-unitarium?
At the moment, no, I'm not.
Okay.
At the moment, even for this one, all I'm saying is that the form of the map is not unique. It's
right. But the motivation was sort of that aiming towards that.
Part of the motivation is to try to understand what is the freedom of choice of the operators, and the freedom of choice of the operators corresponds to a different bath physically, right? Could correspond to a different bath. Here you can actually show, if you go back to this, that one. Right there. You can actually show that if you choose a different row B here, you can choose a different row B here and still get the same phi. And that's kind of easy to see, right? Because if I just change the basis for the bath, right, that I'm tracing over B, so that doesn't make any difference, right? You can also purify the bath. So rather than looking at this row B as a mixed state, which you could do, you can purify that. You can model the bath as some pure state, and it doesn't make any difference. You get the same map because you're tracing over B. So obviously you're losing information about B. So when you lose that information, then you know there's some degree of freedom in there that doesn't affect the bath, right? Or maybe many. And so that's what the unitary degree of freedom is about for the operator some decomposition for completely positive maps. Okay? But I'm not trying to say anything else at this point about it. And so when I do this for the not completely positive maps, basically what I'm saying is that there are other sets of operators which you might think of as corresponding to a different bath, but I can't show exactly how that would occur, is what I'm saying. I have some examples for where that's true, but in general, I can't interpret this pseudo-unitary degree of freedom physically, is what I'm saying. In the completely positive case, I can, but here I can't, okay? I don't know how.
I'm just asking, but the motivation, or the thought in mind was maybe we could sort of think of this as a bath, but we don't know how to.
Right.
We could think of this ansatz is representing a bath, but we don't know quite how.
Exactly, right. So, okay. So, right, so the unitary degree of freedom is used to prove the quantum error correcting code conditions for maps that are completely positive. So, can we do this if it's not completely positive? And I would say sort of. So suppose that we sort of look at what's in Nielsen and Chuang and we write down these conditions. You can write down these conditions, but they look a bit different because there are these etas there, some of which are positive and some of which are negative. And when you go through the proof, which I'll do just sort of sketchily here, you find something very similar. And in fact, if all of these were positive, then you know this is just one over here. And so you get the same error correcting code conditions that are in the book. Okay, well, so it turns out, you know, we take the signature to be UPQ for the eta, basically there are P positive terms and Q negative terms. And just to distinguish between them, I write tildes over the E's that have a minus sign out front. And then we can distinguish two cases. Either this is one, or this in here under the square root is minus one. And if it's minus one, we either have this or this. We can show that the matrix turns out to look like this. So before, for the unitary case, you could show that the right-hand side here was Hermitian. Here, you can show that the right-hand side here, this M, is actually pseudo-Hermitian. And what diagonalizes a pseudo-Hermitian matrix is a pseudo-unitary matrix. Okay? So again, we can diagonalize the thing. We can mimic the proof for the most part that's in Nielsen and Chuang. And then we get... necessary and sufficient conditions for the reversibility of such a map. Okay? So this is a... we only recently proved this. I haven't even posted it on the archive yet. And I wouldn't say that we completely understand this one either. So that's why I said it's good that this is a discussion, because So the proof is easy. Understanding the theorem, what it means, how to use it, and so forth, I would say is not so easy. But the proof is fairly straightforward. It's not so bad once you know about the pseudo-unitary theorem, you can prove this. So I would say this physical interpretation of the pseudo-unitary theorem is not well understood. This is something that troubles me about the whole thing, is that it seems, you know, as we were discussing before, that the map and the initial state can't be completely considered separately. In some sense, you have to talk about them together. But in principle, we can derive these reversibility conditions for these maps. So there's an interesting question as to how that actually would work out in practice. I don't know at the moment. So, okay. So I'm going to skip this part because I'm guessing that, you know, we're kind of out of time, right? This is nearly an hour. So I'll skip this. So by the way, I'm around tomorrow. So if you want to come by, I'm in 220. I'd be happy to discuss more and show details and so forth. Goes for anybody, really. Okay, so I'm going to skip that part. Initial correlations can lead to these maps. If it turns out that, you know, if we had entangled initial states or correlated initial states, people sometimes talk about dynamical decoupling controls as ways to remove errors, but a local unitary transformation can't get rid of these sorts of errors, right, once they're there. So this is something that's maybe maybe something of practical concern. The simulations that we did showed that this not completely positive maps don't really look like a rare event. There are some simple cases where even if they have, I'll just describe this quickly, even if you have some non-zero discord, if everything, for example, is in the Z direction, the initial states and the unitary transformations are Z rotations or ZZ couplings, it turns out that the map would be completely positive, even though we have non-zero discord. So it turns out, though, if you have a little bit of an error in that initial state, that is an X part rather than just a Z part, then you would have a non-completely positive map. And so this is why I say it doesn't look like it's necessarily a rare event. So we prove this theorem, the pseudo-unitary theorem, which provides equivalence classes of maps. For example, due to different physical circumstances, but exactly what those are, how they differ, I'm not sure. There are some reversibility conditions for maps that are not completely positive, and we have this other picture, which I didn't really talk about. But I would say definitely there are quite a few open problems here, as far as I'm concerned, because I don't have the answers to the questions. So, then that's it. So are there any other
questions?
So apart from that sort of line at the end where you said that discord can lead to non-completely positive maps, do your results depend on the relation between discord and it seemed like you talked about it at the beginning and then sort of
I talked about it at the beginning and the end, and then I didn't talk about it much in the middle. Yeah, right. So the theorem says that if the discord is zero, then you will get completely positive maps. So I'm just saying when we're talking about not completely positive maps, we're talking about states that initially have non-zero discord. It turns out, though, that if you have non-zero discord at the beginning, there are some evolutions, some obvious ones like the identity, which won't give you a map that's not completely positive. But if there's zero discord, then you always get a map that's not, completely positive. Okay? Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Yes?
Can you go back to the slide where you give the first example of a state which leads to a non-CP map?
I think so. Oh, there it is. Okay.
So is it the case that there are multiple values of the parameters A and C23 such that you can work out the B map?
Yeah. You can work out, these are the eigenvalues for the B map.
So I guess because the B map doesn't seem, as far as I can tell, to depend on A in any way,
right,
we could say that for the family of rho corresponding to different values of A, there is a unique map which takes each of them to the final state.
Right. You could do this. Now,
and so, right. So
you could input a complete set of A's here and get out a unique map.
So when you say complete set, you just mean not all possible density operators.
Linearly independent.
A family.
A family of linearly independent, like they do for tomography. They put in a set of linearly independent states and they see what you get out. In that case, you can define this map.
Okay, so
on a set of states, and the map would be determined uniquely.
So this seems to me an improvement because it's instead of saying we have defined a map on a single state to a single state, you're saying we have to find a map on a family of states.
Right.
So now, I can believe it's more plausible to say, of all the maps that could possibly take this family to the output space, perhaps every such map is not CP. Whereas I wasn't willing to agree that if you just said, here's, you know, one input state and one final state, there's always a CP map that'll take me from that unique input, that unique output.
Yeah, yeah. So,
but you sort of convinced me, maybe I misunderstood
earlier, but if you just have one input and one output, it's not unique.
Right. And and of that non-unique set, one of the elements is always CP. You can trivially construct one. But what you still haven't convinced me of here is that even though this is better, you've got now a family of input states.
Right.
You've just constructed a map which is non-CP that takes that family to the family output. But you haven't proven to me that there doesn't exist some other map which is CP that does the same thing. There could well be.
Well,
you need to...
In this case, I mean, you know, I take this as my input state, rho. I take that unitary, and I get...
You get one possible map that has that input-output relationship.
Yeah,
but I think you're trying to find
something stronger. If I go through
and I
put in a bunch of different A's, I will get this same eigenvalues. If I put in a linearly independent set of A's there, of initial rows for the subsystem A, I will get this set of eigenvalues.
So what I'm saying is you have here a way of constructing a map that takes this family of input states to a particular family of output states. And the question arises whether this is the only map.
No, but is it, I think it is. He gives it for an arbitrary A.
I mean, this is the way you do tomography. It's basically the map. I mean, that's it.
So the claim is that this family of initial states spans the whole operator space of the input. Is that
those A's? Yeah. If you pick those A's to be linearly independent, then yeah, they span the space of inputs. And that's how you do tomography. You prepare a linearly independent set, and you put them all
And this set of output states.
Statistics.
Pardon? This set of output states also spans the operator space of the output.
I don't think that's necessarily true, but I don't know.
Because I think you need that as well to show that you have completely characterized the map.
Characterized the map by putting all the different input states. I mean, if all the different input states were mapped to the same state, you would still, you know, like relaxation or stuff.
If that were the case, then there'd be a trivial CP map that does it. Trace, and then prepare that final state.
But this one, I think this map is unique because I specify, I mean, particularly in this case, if this is the correlation, right? I mean, this is a physically relevant non-CP map, right? No matter what I choose for A there, you have to choose it so that it's positive input state. But you choose A there, and you can choose a complete set of A's there. You put them through, right, and you do this unitary, and you trace over B, you get the B map, the capital B map, right?
But let's be careful about, so you're fixing C to 3, but you're allowing A to vary. That's the rule, right?
That's right.
And then if you do that, you get a complete set of inputs.
Right. And then
for each one, a unique output state, and
therefore
a unique A map and a unique corresponding B map.
Yes.
You've given the B map.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how to do that in Daniel's example. If you get different C23, different values of C23. Yes?
Let's take another question from the back.
The easiest way to see this, I think, is to take the recipe for process tomography out of Nielsen and Twang, where you take your bunch of fiduciary states and then you do the linear inversion using some standard linear inversion algorithm. And play with that, feeding it a bunch of output states that you got from your fiducial set, and then see how you break it and how easy it is to break it by choosing a set of output density matrices. You just pick them more or less at random. You break it, right? The generic behavior is that it breaks.
So, but the component that you have to add is a way of going from the initial state on the A system to the initial state on the AB system.
Right.
Yeah, that's an assignment map, right? You have to,
yeah, so,
that
so
extension,
you,
that's non-unique.
Right,
right?
So,
the
so that's, so you put that in, you put that
in
as part of the
cross-representation theorem, which we all know and love, makes an extremely strong assumption about the initial form of that state, which is that it's in Stein spring form, right? You have your initial density matrix, you have a tensor product, and then you have an initial state on the environment system, which is not a function of your initial state on your system of interest. Where not a function does not only means not entangled, it means not classically correlated either. Right? You can break this using just classical correlations. You don't need entanglement at all, right? Which is why it comes out to be the discord and not an entangled matrix being a defining parameter.
And so the statement in that other theorem then of is that if the initial state has no discord for any of these possible input states, is that correct?
Well, it's a statement about the relationship between your system of interest and your environment. Right? What you're looking for.
Yeah, that's right. So, but you're running it over a variety of possible states of the A system. So the
well, I think you have to do that to define the discord.
Yeah, discord is defined on a single state.
Right.
But to do that, to define the map here, you've agreed you have to run over a set of possible states. And
yeah.
the statement of the theorem is that the discord should be zero for all initial states in this family.
Yeah, that sounds about right. It's been a while since I looked at
this
stuff.
These states are not enough for tomography, though. So by definition, of discord.
If you use the standard thing for a CP map and the map, the initial state is always rho tensor zero, then it has zero discord always.
Right.
I think it can't be true in the following sense, that if I engineer a map which takes every input state to a unique state on the system, okay?
Unique AB state.
No, I just mean that the marginal on the system finally, it has no, it doesn't vary at all as I move among elements of the family of the input states.
No. So I think the way you have to do it is you have to say, we're going to take the input state.
Uh-huh.
We have this canonical way. I mean, not canonical. It's part of the system of taking the A state into an AB state.
Sure.
We say that there's a unique AB state for each A state. And then you do this unitary, you trace over the B system.
Sure.
And you're left with something.
Yeah, okay. So
that's a well-defined map from given these constraints.
Right. And so here's, imagine a case where your prescription has you swap something into the system at the end, which is sort of unrelated to what you put in at the beginning. So some fixed state gets swapped into the system at the very end. So now that the overall, that there will always exist a CP map from system to system that can describe this because it just traces over what that family of stuff you put in and reprepares that fixed final state. So any theorem that says if the system environment state has non-zero discord, then the map will have to be non-CP cannot be right without some further caveats that say, furthermore, the range of output states on the system for that family of inputs must span the space or something like that.
There's got to be some extra condition which says that you don't lose dimensionality, right? So
that would be another way of putting it. That'd be another way of putting it.
So the Shabani, the DAR paper, they only look at point where there is a CP map for all unitaries, so you've got system environment, you've got a unitary acting on it.
I see, so that's the
and they say for all unitaries, but on top of that, they have a condition on how you construct the maps that they have a very specific form, so not, doesn't apply to all possible maps you could construct in the system.
Right, that unitary is going to stop you mashing it.
So the thing is that if you take two states that have zero discord, but in a different basis, so they're diagonalized in a different basis, some of these states will have non-zero discord. So that basically kills linearity of your map. So you have to sort of confine your map to only work on states that are diagonal in the same basis. If you change the basis, you have to have a different map. It will be CP. So if you allow your map to be non-CP, then it will work on CP.
So can you summarize exactly what the statement of the theorem is then?
So the first theorem says, if you've got a family of states and they're all diagonally in the same basis, then you can, for any unitary you're given,
system environment, you can construct a completed positive, assuming you know the initial correlations. So you know that if it's 1, then it's correlated to X in the environment. If it's 2, it's correlated to B in the environment. If it's 3, all in the diagonal, right? For each diagonal, you have to have different correlations, different methods. The reverse statement says there is a specific way of constructing a map, and give the specific way of constructing a map. If you follow this prescription, you will only get a completely positive map for all unitaries, not for just one unitary, for all unitaries, if you have zero discordance. So this prescription doesn't work if the discordance. So they kind of argue in the paper that that prescription is sort of the only physical way of interpreting the results. But it doesn't coincide with tomography. So if you do tomography, any kind of correlation will kill it.
So I think the critical thing is the for all unitaries part of that theorem.
Yeah,
that's very strong.
So you're saying zero discord is a necessary condition for that particular prescription to work?
Yes.
So it's not a statement of what other prescription might work or might not.
No,
in fact,
you can find
color. Like grab prescription.
Color.
Yes.
I mean, part of your trouble here, right, is you're trying to do, one of the fundamental problems of process tomography is it scales abominably, right? You've got to measure some horrendous number of parameters. I think it's 256 for a 2-qubit map, or something unbelievable, right? Now, as people have probably worked out, part of this trouble is because we're assuming that this thing is linear, right, when it quite really isn't, because it isn't defined on all density matrices, right? There's an implicit dependence on what density matrix you feed in simply because it's not defined on density matrices. Well, the trouble with that is, okay, I'm going to go and make this thing nonlinear. Right, now, do you know how many parameters you're going to have to measure if you want to reconstruct a quadratic map? You don't want to know, right? You really don't want to know. So you'd be far better off using a linear map, right? Nasty hack though it is, because it actually gives you something that you can do in a reasonable length of time, right? So to some extent, we are living with the problems that come from making an assumption of linearity, simply because, you know, there's an epistemological problem here. We can't do enough measurements for it to be a usable tool if we had put an extra term in that expansion, right, and look at a quadratic term. Right, we'll be here forever, right? So, you know, if you've got a model which allegedly predicts everything but is prohibitively difficult to calculate, who uses that model? Wouldn't it be better to have a cruder model which is less accurate but which is possible to extract a prediction from?
Do we have more questions? But we've had a lengthy discussion already. So let's maybe thank Mark again.